I think the content of this talk, as you can see, is Living Without the Law. The speaker is Ralph Critchfield here on my left. I don't think there's really much more of an introduction to give, so over to you.
Well, comrade chair and comrades, I don't know whether the idea has got around that the Socialist Party is holding a weekend stall here this weekend about living without the state. I didn't observe any signs of any great sort of moral deprivation as I came to Oxford to get here, because what strikes me is that to talk about living without the state is talking to people about living without something which is generally regarded as pretty essential in modern society, the state being seen as something which is really quite benign and almost parental. For example, in the recent election for the leadership of the Labour Party, all the three candidates put themselves forward as prospective prime ministers who, if they ever got into number 10, will make sure that they manage the state machine in British capitalism as something which is benign and which bestows all sorts of benign things upon us. So if we talk about living without the state, we're telling people we're going to live without something which is necessary in their lives and which is protective and progressive. And that also applies to this thing called the law, which I'm supposed to be talking about today. And of course, the law is an essential adjunct of the state. But again, people regard the law in very much the same way. If you were to get on that omnibus in Clapham and ask anybody, what do you think about living without the law? They'd say, my God, if there wasn't the law, everybody in this bus would be fighting each other. Nobody would be paying any fares. They'd smash up the bus. The bus would never get where it's supposed to go. And so everybody would be thoroughly dissatisfied. So the law is also regarded as something benign and necessary because it's supposed to keep order. It stops people walking along the streets and having fights and stealing things, so it protects property, and it also cares for the vulnerable people in society. It cares for children and old people and sick people and all the rest of it. Now, the assumption, another assumption that goes with the idea that the law is necessary in society is that it imposes a type of higher morality in our lives. The law is something which, if we all stick to, then life is going to be much more orderly, it's going to be much better, and we ourselves are going to be operating in a much more efficient way. There is something which we've all heard of called justice, which is supposed to be the implementation of the law, and justice is supposed to be something which is impartial and fair, and is supposed to assess a particular event, decide who's responsible for something happening, and then if necessary punish somebody or award somebody else according to the principles of this so-called justice. So the assumption is that without that sort of law, without that sort of organisation, without justice, we're going to have a pretty chaotic sort of society. Now, this was expressed by a man, you must all have heard of him, a man, I think he's Lord Donaldson now, but at the time he was just Sir John Donaldson. And he was chairman of the National Industrial Relations Court, which was a thing set up by the Heath government in the 70s in order to administer the anti-trade union laws, which they introduced. And Donaldson mucked the job up, really, because he took the law seriously. And as a result of that, well, we'll come to judges' sort of political functioning in a bit, I suppose, but he took it seriously. He looked at the law and said you may remember there were some dockers, and there eventually got to be five dockers who were defying the anti-trade union laws passed by the Heath government. And Donaldson said, I'm a judge, so if these people have broken the law, I'm going to put them in prison. And the Heath government said, my God, we didn't really mean this to happen. So they found somebody called the official solicitor, who had never been heard of by any reasonable, normal people up to that date, has never been heard of since, as far as I know. But they said to this guy, the official solicitor, who was probably astounded that anybody was ever going to make use of his services, that he had to go along to Pentonville Prison and somehow get these dockers out of prison. But being a civil servant and probably sort of comfortably paid, he went along and he did it, and the five dockers came out. But in sending them to prison, this is what Donaldson said. He said, by their conduct, these men are saying they are above the rule of law. No court should ignore such a challenge. To do so would imperil all law and order. Now, that's a fairly common sort of statement which you expect to hear from judges and politicians and magistrates and people like that. But what Donaldson is saying there is that the worst possible prospect is that there will be a breakdown of law and order. So if these five dockers did this, there will be like a virus spreading out from Pentonville Prison, and in the end the whole of society will be deprived of law and order, and there will be no protection for anybody, there will be no points of reference for anybody to organise their lives. And that's a fairly common attitude towards the law. Now, what the law is, in fact, is that it is a state-imposed definition of certain relationships arising from the property basis of society. It defines relationships between individuals, and in individuals I also count corporations, companies and organisations like that, and it also defines the relationships between the individuals and the state. And all of these balance on the basic fact of capitalist society, that there are property rights in existence, that there is a class monopoly of the means of wealth production and distribution, and all the superstructure of society arises from that. It follows then that if we remove the property rights from society, if we have a society with a different basis, then we don't have to have the laws which we live under today. And the reason that people may regard the proposition that we live in a society in future without laws, they would regard that with horror, is that they would say that there are no standards of morality, therefore, and that behaviour would not be defined. So, if we could look first of all at the business about the standards of morality, because the law is supposed to represent, isn't it, as I said before, a higher morality. There is an assumption that if we are this thing called law-abiding, then we live by a certain moral code, which enables us to exist peacefully and efficiently and in cooperation with other human beings. Now, in fact, of course, the morality which the law applies is not something which is fixed and unchanging. It's something which varies according to the requirements of capitalist society at any one particular time. A fairly trivial example of this is something that I can remember, and I'm not going to bore you with a lot of reminiscences from my childhood, though it was a very interesting childhood I had. I can remember that when I was a kid, one of the things which the law said was illegal and therefore immoral was something called off-course betting. If you wanted to put some money on a horse, you had to go to a race course to do it, or you had to have an account with a bookmaker. Well, of course, there were millions of members of the working class who tried to enliven their very drab and impoverished lives by putting just a few pence on a horse. But they weren't enabled to do that. So there were people called bookies runners, and they used to live all over the place. So if my parents wanted to put some money on a horse, they used to give it to me or some other member of my family in a tightly wrapped up piece of paper, and I used to slink along the street looking out for the police, because what I was doing and what that man was doing, whose house I used to take the bet to, was illegal. And the police used to expend an enormous amount of energy in trying to catch these people. They were always raiding this man's house looking for these bets, and on the occasions that they found it, they used to drag him into court, because he was doing something illegal and therefore immoral. But suddenly that situation changed, and as you know, that is no longer illegal. Kids don't have to scurry along the streets now taking bets to bookies runners. There are betting shops where people can go and do this. So that's an example of the morality of the law changing in a particular direction, something being decriminalised. And in the other direction, at one time it was moral for anybody who lived in this thing that used to be called the British Empire or the British Commonwealth of Nations, it was perfectly moral and legal for them to come quite freely into this country. And again, another chunk of my childhood, I can remember in the regular lessons we used to have about the glory of the British Empire, being told that one of its great moral influences in the world was the fact that it was this family of nations, and that anybody could move around within the British Empire, that anybody could come from India or Canada or Australia or wherever, the Fiji Islands, they could come quite freely into this country. And that was presented as something which was highly moral. But then in 1962, for particular political reasons, that was seen as something which was politically inconvenient. And so we had the first Commonwealth Immigration Act, and the restrictions which were imposed under that act have progressively been tightened up over the years by Labour governments as well as Tory governments. And so now we get the situation where it is immoral for people to come illegally into this country. Unless they come under the correct legal definitions, then they are hunted down by the police, subjected to some extreme treatment, and it is quite, and certainly to organise it is regarded as an extremely serious offence for which people will go to prison for quite a long time. Another example of that developing trend will be seen in the new Criminal Justice Act. You've probably seen that, I think it was a couple of weeks ago, there was a demonstration in London against the provisions of this Act, in which things which have hitherto been quite legal and therefore moral are going to be held to be illegal and therefore immoral. Another assumption about the law is that it not only imposes a higher morality, but that it also punishes people who breach that morality. It punishes people who are do things which are forbidden under the law. But again, when we look at the reality of this situation, we find that it just isn't so. I know you're all pretty familiar with cases like the Birmingham Six and the Guildford Four, and certain associated offences which arose from bombing incidents and other similar things committed by the IRA. And you all know, of course, that what was quite clearly established in all of those cases was that there was severe malpractice by the police. What happened was that the police were under a lot of pressure to arrest people quickly for these incidents, so they weren't too bothered about the strength of the evidence. They just grabbed hold of people who seemed to be convenient, and they then beat them up until they made some sort of confession for the offences, and other evidence was also bent, and eventually these people ended up doing very, very long prison sentences. They were sentenced to life imprisonment, and they served sort of 15, 16, 17 years before eventually the thing collapsed and they were let out of prison. Now, there was an inquiry recently into the case of the Guildford Four, which you've also probably heard about, chaired by a man called Sir John May, who used to be a judge in the appeal court and who was generally considered to be a judge of independent mind. Now, he said about the Guildford Four case, in his report, he said that the system was perfectly okay. There's absolutely nothing wrong with the system that allows people to be picked up and beaten up and subsequently sentenced to long terms of imprisonment for something which they hadn't done, which everybody knew they hadn't done. In fact, in the case of the Guildford Four and the Birmingham Six, if you talk to anybody who was familiar with them, in prison or out of prison, everybody, including the police, were absolutely sure that these people hadn't done this. But the Sir John May inquiry said there's absolutely nothing wrong with this. What had happened was that there were one or two individual failings. Well, Lord Lane, who was not who at the time was Lord Chief Justice, and who wasn't famous for his liberal and lenient attitude towards people who came in front of him, and who certainly dealt pretty harshly with any appeals which he thought challenged the legal system, when the Guildford Four were eventually set free by the appeal court in 1989, he said that what's quite obvious in this case is that the police have lied, and so the police officers concerned, these individuals, should be prosecuted, and he hoped that this should be pretty soon. Well, that was in 1989, and 4 years later they got those police in the dock, and inevitably it seemed they were acquitted. So the individuals that Sir John May had put the finger on here said that there were individual failings. Individuals had twisted things, have bent the law, behaved in an unacceptable way. Nothing happened to them. They weren't punished. So in other words, this is an example, and there are plenty more, where the people who are responsible for breaking the law are not in fact punished. Another example which is quite interesting was the case of the defendants in the Guinness trial. You may remember these were some people who were pretty rich people who in fact stole quite a lot of money, and the it doesn't matter to me who they stole it from. I couldn't care less if they steal money from each other, but they did, and I wasn't sure that the way they did it, it was all connected with some sort of share dealing. And since I don't own shares, and I'm not likely to, it's of absolutely no interest to me. There was a man called Ernest Saunders who was in charge of Guinness at the time, and he masterminded the whole thing, and he was responsible for stealing millions and millions of pounds. Now, if you go along and you manage to steal, say, £20,000 from your employer on Monday and you're caught, you'll get a substantial prison sentence, and you'll start off serving that prison sentence in a closed prison where conditions are pretty grotty, and you'll move very slowly through the system, and towards the end of your sentence you'll go to an open prison. That's the way the system works. But Ernest Saunders, having stolen millions and millions of pounds, got just 5 years, and almost overnight he was sent to an open prison, Ford in Sussex. I don't really know, it's sort of near the seaside, and it's really quite pleasant. Something like this, actually. It's flat, and the people there are just as nice as you lot as well. They're a lot cleverer than some of us, but still. Anyway, Ernest Saunders was sent down to Ford, and he sort of wandered around in the sunshine for a bit, and then suddenly the Home Office said, Ernest Saunders has got Alzheimer's disease. Well, Alzheimer's disease, as you probably know, is a degenerative condition, and there is no cure for Alzheimer's disease. So the Home Office said, well, we've got to be nice to this guy, he's got this dreadful disease, so we let them out. Never mind about the fact that there are thousands of people in prison who aren't like Ernest Saunders. We do have dreadful diseases. One of the Guild Four, for example, was dying of tuberculosis and died in prison, in fact, and the Home Office did nothing about him. But they said, Ernest Saunders has got Alzheimer's disease, so we must let him out. And promptly when he got out, he had this miraculous cure of Alzheimer's disease, which has never been known before and is at the moment medically impossible. The point was, of course, that Ernest Saunders was let out because he wasn't just like a member of the working class who'd stolen some money from his employer. So this, again, is an example of how the law and the legal system works in a particular way. And I don't want to make too much of this point, having gone on about it for a very long time, because having said all that, as I'm going to say in a bit, it really is quite irrelevant. Now, the point about the law, and it didn't, perhaps I'm a bit naive, it didn't strike me until I started to read up stuff for this meeting, quite how all-pervasive the law is. From the moment you're born, the law comes into operation. There are laws about your parentage, the property that you might have or might not have, your parentage and the obligations of your parents and your education, all the rest of it. And that goes on all through your life. There are masses and masses of laws until the point when you die, when there are laws about how you're going to be certified as dead and what's going to happen if you've got a bit of money or something like this. And there's criminal law, there's property law, there's laws of contract, which don't bother me. There are laws about negotiable instruments. You know, you have bills of exchange and checks and things like that. And there's public order law, and it goes on and on and on. And, of course, there are volumes and volumes written about this sort of thing. And as the laws develop, they repeal or modify other laws. For example, the present Public Order Act, which is in operation, until this new one comes in operation. These are three acts. I chose these because of their particularly blood-curdling titles. It repeals completely three acts, the Tumultuous Petitioning Act of 1661. Now, you didn't know that after 1984, you could have offended the Tumultuous Petitioning Act of 1661, did you? And the Shipping Offences Act of 1793 and the Seditious Meetings Act of 1817. And it partly repealed other things like the Vagrancy Act, which is beloved of courts, beloved of magistrates' courts in particular, because they can get people into court under all sorts of pretences under the Vagrancy Act of 1824. And it also partly repealed the Erith Tramways and Improvement Act, and I could go on and on. Now, I only say this because, and I'm going to come on this, like there's a huge industry of people who train extensively and who spend all their lives tracing these laws and what's repealed by what and how to write a law so that the Erith Tramways and Improvements Act is repealed properly. It's not repealed improperly, because otherwise people in Erith on the tramways might get mixed up about something. And of course, at the same time as there are laws, there are other laws which say how those laws must be applied. There are Magistrates' Courts Acts, for example. And there is something called the Police and Criminal Evidence Act, which lays down the procedure that the police are supposed to follow, and when they get you into court, about the powers of the court. And again, there's this enormous industry of people dealing with this sort of thing. And I came across an example of this just a little while ago. I was whiling away a morning, so I was in a court, so I went and sat in this court, where a firm was being prosecuted for mucking around with a tachograph, a transport firm, being prosecuted for mucking around with the tachographs on its lorries. Now, you know the regulations about tachographs. They're designed to stop or to modify the possibility of lorry drivers working overtime, falling asleep at the wheel and ploughing into a bus queue or something like this. So it's not a bad idea, is it? And I guess if I was a lorry driver, I wouldn't want to work long hours until I was keeling over over the steering wheel. And this firm was prosecuted for mucking around with its tachographs. Now, in this court, there were two barristers and two solicitors, and they had their clerks, and there were the court officials, and there was a stipendiary magistrate who, as you know, is a qualified lawyer who's paid to be a magistrate, all sitting there, and this argument went on and on and on about this firm and the tachographs. Now, the interesting thing was that nobody contested the fact that this firm had mucked around with a tachograph. What was being contested was whether the prosecution had been brought under the correct part of the Road Transport Act. And this stipendiary was really enjoying this, because this is what he's good at, you see. He's very clever. He knows. And he was quoting this act and the subsections, and they were all leaping up. And I listened to this for an hour, and it had gone on long before I got there. It was going to go on for a long time after I left.
Now, that is an example of this industry that I'm talking about. These people are well, like people on a production line. You go into a factory and you see people bent over machines and the oil and the heat and the noise and the metal coming. They were just like people on a production line. They had this enormous knowledge and they were very wrapped up in what they were doing. And they probably went home at night thinking they'd done a thoroughly good job. I don't know what happened to the firm or what happened to the prosecution. Lord Denning once, you may have heard of Lord Denning, I'm going to come back to him later on, because I always had, I don't know about you, I have favourite members of the capitalist class, favourite members of the ruling class who irritate me or amuse me, and Lord Denning used to be my favourite judge. He was preceded by a man called Lord, I'm not sure whether he was Lord Chief Justice, his name was Goddard, wasn't it, who used to love sentencing people to death, and had a, used to go through a sort of sexual experience every time he sentenced people to death. And he looked very gruesome as well. But Lord Denning, he used to be Master of the Rolls. As you know, judges always have to have funny names, and the fact that he was called Master of the Rolls didn't mean to say that he worked for Mother's Pride Bakery. I don't know what Master of the Rolls means, except that he's in charge of the Court of Appeal. And Lord Denning was supposed to be a man who ran the Court of Appeal on the basis of common sense. But having read quite a lot of what he's written, and having listened to them, sort of followed his career for a while with interest, common sense seemed to be the last thing that ever sort of got through his brain. But he was talking about this business about the industry of the law, and he said not a single page. He talks about three volumes. This was in 1970. I'm sure they're much more than three. 3,000 pages each of interpretation of the statute. So if you want to know what the statutes are about, you've got to read 9,000 pages of it. And he says not a single page, it's not even straightforward then when you've read it, he says not a single page, but it can give rise to argument. So if you're going to sit there arguing about 9,000 pages, every page 9,000 pages, he says books and books have been written on the interpretation of statutes. Now he likes this, thinks it's great, but of course what it is, it's an enormous waste of human effort, and it's an enormously inefficient society that operates in that sort of way. And even after that, we do get these things called miscarriages of justice. Even after the 9,000 pages have been read and argued about and interpreted, we still get those miscarriages of justice. Now, a guy called Lord Kilmuir, who was Lord Chancellor under Macmillan, who was sacked actually by Macmillan on that occasion where he sacked everybody who happened to be walking down 10 Downing Street that day. There was a programme about it recently on TV, wasn't there? And Lord Kilmuir was very bitter because he thought he'd done an excellent job as Lord Chancellor. He said that a wrongful conviction for murder after the processes of a trial and appeal and House of Lords, all these sort of fail-safe mechanisms, was in the realms of fantasy. But of course we know it's not in the realms of fantasy because people are convicted wrongfully of murder. I talked about the Birmingham Six, but there's so many other examples as well. There was that man called Stefan Kisko, who wasn't a member of the IRA, who was convicted of the sexual murder of a small child. And the significant thing was that at the time of his arrest, there was actually, in the hands of the police, material scientific evidence which showed that the man could not possibly have done this. But this didn't stop the guy being convicted of murder, and had there been a death penalty, of course, he would have been executed. And he then spent something like 14 years, I think, in prison, and because of his offence, he had an extremely rough time. And when he came out, he didn't last very long. He died of a heart attack. So this is the reality of what Lord Kilmuir said was pure fantasy. And of course, underneath the publicised cases, there are lots and lots of people who aren't convicted of murder, convicted of lesser offences through the same sort of mechanism. Now, why does this sort of thing happen? Why is it that so many people are wrongfully convicted? There was a survey of a prison called Long Larton down in Worcestershire. It's near Evesham, Long Larton. And something like a third, just under a third of the prisoners there, it was considered, had serious grounds for questioning the basis of their imprisonment. So why does all this happen? Well, why is it that when these things happen, and if they're publicised, nothing is done as a result of it? Well, coming back to Lord Denning, he was talking... he was giving a judgment in a case, I think it was in the theatre, where the union was trying to restrict employment. And what he said about that in giving his judgment, as an aside, he said, "Let no one say that in this we are prejudiced. We have but one prejudice, that is to uphold the law, and that we will do whatever befalls. Nothing shall deter us from doing our duty." Now, that was what you're saying in 1977. When he came to give a judgment on the Birmingham Six, who were taking an action, actually, against the police, they first of all tried to get some prison officers convicted of beating them up in prison. When that failed, that indicated that the injuries they had when they arrived at prison must have been caused by the police, so they took an action against the police. And this is what Denny said about this, and this was in 1918. He said, just consider the course of events if this action is allowed to proceed. If the six men win, that's the Birmingham Six, it means that the police were guilty of perjury. They were guilty of violence and threats, that the confessions were involuntary and were improperly admitted in evidence. In other words, that the courts and the judges also at fault, and that the convictions were erroneous. That would mean the Home Secretary would either have to recommend they be pardoned or he would have to remit the case to the Court of Appeal. This is such an appalling vista that every sensible person in the land would say it cannot be right that these actions should go any further. Now, what Dennings is saying is that whether these blokes are guilty or not, whether they've got a case against the police or not, if we admit that, that is an appalling vista. We're saying there are going to be all sorts of consequences would follow from that, which we are going to find highly inconvenient. And that really is the reason that these things are carried on and are supported. Denning, in fact, when the guilt of poor were released, he said, I'm sorry, I went a bit over the top there, words to that effect. But of course he's a bit late then, they've been in prison for another 11 years. So what he's saying there is that really the law is very essential to capitalist society, and that whether it operates as they present it to us, then it must be assumed to operate correctly within their terms, and it can't be challenged. And that is because the law does assert property rights, and because it protects the privileges of capitalist society, so it must be seen to be effective. And as Denning said, if it is proved that the police and the court, and he even mentioned the Home Secretary at the time, didn't he, if they're involved in any of this, then the law becomes in disrepute, the whole system is seriously challenged, and we get what Denning called this appalling vista. And beside that sort of prospect, what really did the lives of six people matter? Six members of the working class who might spend 15, 16, 17 years in prison put in the balance, of course, they don't count for very much. Now, Denning himself, and I think this is the last time I'm going to quote this man, he talked about the function of the court. This is in 1952, and he said, a man's right to work. One of the things about Lord Denning is that for most of the time, judging by what he said and he wrote, he lived in a world where women didn't exist, because he was always talking about men's rights. And how men behave. He says a man's right to work is just as important to him, if not more important, than his rights of property. These courts intervene every day to protect the rights of property. They must also intervene to protect the rights to work. What he was talking about was this is a common argument about protecting the rights to work. They were talking about a case where a trade union was trying to restrict recruitment into an industry. And this case, this point about the rights to work, is always brought out in that sort of situation. Now, of course, trade unions don't have very much clout, so they can't work in the closed shop. And it's also brought out if trade unionists start picketing. It's never brought out. Nobody ever mentions this so-called right to work when workers are made redundant. That's considered to be absolutely acceptable. No judge ever gets up and says these people are being made redundant, but they have a right to work, so the firm can't sack them. It's considered to be absolutely acceptable. But Denning there indicated quite clear that they protect, the courts are there really to protect the rights of property. And if we see the legal system as something which is not operating as it's supposed to do, that is an aspect of the fact that we live in a decadent society which can't fulfil human needs. It's a society in which corruption is very often an acceptable way of organising affairs, and the law is not above this. Now, the response to this sort of situation, the response of the reformists, is to say that we have to improve the legal system. There's a move at the moment, for example, and this is being bitterly resisted, of course, to stop judges and barristers wearing wigs and gowns in court to make them look like ordinary human beings. But if you read any analysis of cases like the Birmingham Six and the Guildford Four, at the end of it, the people who were involved in exposing these cases always come up with the idea of reforming the law so that the law will work a bit more efficiently and we won't have the possibility of these so-called miscarriages of justice. But of course we as socialists aren't going to be concerned with reforming the law at all. We're making one or two adjustments so that judges are differently dressed or sit in different types of places. They don't. If you go to the Old Bailey, you'll see the judges sort of sitting halfway up in space, and this doesn't exactly encourage any confidence when you're talking to them. We're talking about a society in which the legal system doesn't exist, that there aren't laws at all. And the opposition to this, if you were going to get onto the omnibus in Oxford or wherever, and talk to people about wanting a society in which laws don't exist, there will be this shock horror reaction. It will be based on the assumption that human beings need external controls, that we don't have internal controls. We don't assess situations and make judgments in terms of human interests and cooperation, that we have to have this vast legal machinery outside which tells us what to do, how to get on a bus, how to pay the fare, how to go to work, how to behave, not to, to start fighting in the street and things like that. And that without those external controls, we'll run riot, there will be public disorder, we'll deal with any problems in an antisocial way. Now, this, of course, is part of the argument about so-called human nature, which assumes that although human beings can esteem themselves, although that's a matter of personal pride, supposedly, and although they can esteem themselves as part of a nationality, people are supposed to be proud to be British or proud to be French or something, that's called patriotism and is highly valued and esteemed. But what human beings mustn't do is to have regard for themselves as a species, to say that the human species is useful and behaves in acceptable and cooperative ways. That's, if you put that point of view, that we could have a society based on human cooperation, you're considered to be naive. Humans are assumed to be competitive and never cooperative, and they assume that they can never have any real stake in society. They've got to be continually alienated against society. Now, presumably we'll discuss this a bit more later on, but at the moment what we can say is that if this concept of human beings were true, then it's very unlikely that we would have developed to the point at which we have today. Human beings would not have built this sort of society which we have today. We would not have developed it to the point at which a society of human cooperation and free access to wealth is a distinct and pretty well immediate possibility. The argument about human nature always seem to apply as well to acts which are seen as damaging. For example, the police, who are a chief of police or a chief constable, whatever they call themselves, will often declaim about human nature, and he would do that describing a particular type of offence which is perhaps unpleasant, and unpleasant consequences for some people involved in an armed robbery or a particular act of violence or something like that, and they will end up their analysis of this by saying, well, what can you expect, that's human nature, isn't it? But at the same time they will praise perhaps the police officers who are involved, who they say behave bravely, and it never occurs to them that what they're saying is that that human beings, at the same time as the behaviour was, according to them, unacceptable, there are other human beings behaving what they said was an acceptable way. But whenever we get examples of constructive and cooperative behaviour, people never say, well, what can you expect? That is just human nature, isn't it? And if there is such a thing as human nature, it doesn't exclude cooperation. It's as natural to help as to harm. It's as natural to cooperate as to compete. What we can say about human nature is it is something, or rather human behaviour, which people wrongly classify as human nature. What we can say is that it is a reaction to our condition. The present social system encourages us to be competitive. The role models which it puts forward are not those of cooperation. They're those of acquisitiveness, they're those of destructiveness. You may have seen, I think it was last week, a programme about the Canadians in Bomber Command during the war, when they had these two pilots who went back to visit German cities which they had bombed. And the whole theme of the programme was about the not just the offensive of Bomber Command and what happened, but also the tremendous casualties that they incurred, and the fact that the man in charge, this man Harris, had this mission in life to kill as many Germans as possible. And this was the basis of the Bomber Command offensive. And these two men who piloted bombers were obviously extremely lucky, or perhaps extremely cowardly. They managed to survive an awful lot of raids anyway. They'd gone back to these German cities and they were confronted with some frightful stories. They met the chief of a fire brigade. It was either Hamburg or Cologne, And they met two women who'd lived through the air raids, who told them after an instant about what they'd seen during the air raids. Now, the whole point about this, these two men were heroes. They'd been decorated, and they'd come through it all. But they had been involved in the most frightful acts of indiscriminate destruction and killing. Their job was to just wipe out whole areas of human population. But that wasn't considered to be unacceptable behaviour. And that's the sort of standards which capitalism produces in people. Now, what we're talking about is a society of safety. We're talking about human beings having safe conditions. We're talking about a society in which we stand equally about the wealth in society, about access to wealth, and we stand equally about the ownership of the means of wealth production and distribution. Now, that's a safe society. So we argue that in those sort of conditions, safe conditions, human beings are going to act in a safe way. They are going to cooperate. They are going to see cooperation as the highest morality of society. They're going to see caring for each other as the highest morality of society. People offend against the laws of capitalism today, which are represented to them as the high morality, because they are alienated from this society. And it's not difficult to be alienated from capitalism. If you don't come up to the standards of capitalism, then it's very easy to feel that you don't have a place in the society, so that you are going to offend against its morals. A recent study, for example, found that about almost half the people in prison had committed offences linked to excess intake of alcohol or abusing drugs. Now, why do people drink a hell of a lot, and why do people abuse themselves with drugs? The answer is they do that because that's their way of dealing with the problems of capitalist society, and that leads directly to them committing offences, leads them coming up into court and going into prison. Now, socialist society will not be that sort of society. There's another link which is established, even the police accept this now, there's a link which has been established between unemployment and crime. And, of course, capitalism regards the employed worker as somebody who is being exploited and therefore useful. And if a worker is not employed, is not exploitable and not being exploited, then that worker isn't useful and so has to be treated in a particular way. And it's very easy, and this is something which is widespread in this country at the moment, then to feel alienated and despairing and feel that you don't have a place in society. And so it's very easy from that point to feel that you should offend against the requirements of that society. Now, so the laws of capitalism say that theft and violence must be on their terms, and that's typical of the morality which capitalism imposes. We want a different sort of society. We want a society which doesn't just have the state machine, but doesn't have any of the appurtenances as well. We want a society without the state and a society without the laws. But that's not to say that we want a society without its own morality and without its own presumptions. But in a free and safe society where people do stand equally about the basis of our lives, then that's a perfectly possible society, and it's one which we're all working towards. Thank you.